Their primary mission will be to insert Gadajok strike teams onto the surface of Coronair, where they will free the Coronari and extract them using boxcars. General Tellus again paused as he prepared to discuss the final group. The fourth subgroup will be tasked with capturing the Tayenta and escaping with her for later rendezvous at a predetermined location. This will likely be the greatest challenge of the entire mission. Were it not for the presence of an operative inside the Tayenta, it would not even be considered. "Who's inside the Tayenta?" Josh wondered out loud. When everyone looked at him, he apologized. "Sorry, jeez." Nathan looked at Tellus, nodding. "That's quite all right, Mr. Hayes. The operative inside the Tayenta is Sue Van Navarro, captain of the ill-fated Avondale." Murmurs of surprise and disbelief filled the room.
"I thought he went down with the Avondale,"
Josh said. "As did we," General Tellus agreed. "We later learned that he was not aboard the Avondale when she was destroyed by the Dusan, and he somehow made his way to Takara, where, using a fake identity, he secured a job as a crawler operator on the Tayenta's assembly crew. This mission is based on ideas and data communicated to us by Captain Navarro."
"And how does he suggest we steal a battleship?"
Josh wondered. Again, he felt the eyes of everyone in the room on him.
"Like you aren't all wondering the same thing."
"That's what we are here to discuss, Mr. Hayes," the general replied. "There are many details to work out, and we only have 3 days to prepare."
"What happens in 3 days?"
Josh asked. "The Tayenta will go into service, and will be impossible to capture, and the Coronari will be moved to their various work camps, making them far more difficult to rescue."
"And if we figure out that we can't pull off both objectives?"
Commander Verbeek questioned. "Then we concentrate on rescuing the Coronari," Nathan insisted. "They would do the same for us." General Tellus waited for any dissenting voices. As expected, there were none. "Let us begin."
"Get those containers open as soon as possible,"
Captain Hunt barked as he slid down the gangway rails from the catwalk above into the cargo hold.
"And get a medical team ready just in case."
The cargo handlers immediately began laser-cutting the seals on the containers and unlatching them. With each case that opened, two persons would come falling out, shivering from the cold and weak from being cramped up for hours inside the small containers. Crewmen helped them out, moving them to the sides where others brought blankets, water, and in many cases, oxygen.
"This one," Captain Hunt ordered. "The big one. Denny, Sackoff, give me a hand,"
he added as he made his way to the large cargo pod at the aft end of the bay. Denny went to work with a laser, carefully cutting through the sealing strips, designed to prevent tampering with the cargo during transport. Within a minute, he had unsealed the doors at one end of the large pod, and crewman Sackoff began unlatching them. Once open, the two crewmen began moving into the container, but Captain Hunt stopped them.
"Wait,"
Captain Hunt ordered. The two crewmen stepped back, and Captain Hunt ducked down, entering the container.
"Kayla, you in here?"
"Back here,"
Kayla yelled from deeper within. Captain Hunt moved inside, working his way around to the access hatch of the larger container, which was stored in the back of the container they had just opened. He looked inside and spotted Kayla and a man he did not recognize.
"Are you all right?"
he asked Kayla.
"Yes, I'm fine."
"Who the hell is this?"
Chris asked.
"My name is Crispin Bornett,"
Crispin replied. Captain Hunt's eyes grew wide as he recognized the name. He quickly drew his sidearm, activating its power pack as he brought it up to take aim at the man.
"Wait!"
Kayla yelled.
"He's a friend!"
"The hell he is!"
Chris argued. "I've been watching the news, Kayla. This bastard killed Nathan's whole fucking family."
"He didn't do it,"
Kayla insisted. "He was set up."
"How the hell can you be sure?"
"He told me the whole thing," she replied. "And I believe him."
"You're just gonna take his word for it?"
Chris questioned, surprised by her gullibility.
"I've known him since I was young. You've got to trust me on this, Chris. He knows things. Things that Nathan is going to want to know."
"What?
Wait," Crispin said, confused.
"Oh, I'm sure Nathan's going to want to ask him a few questions,"
Chris agreed, looking at Kayla. Crispin took advantage of the captain's diverted attention and snapped the weapon from his hands, immediately training it back on the captain.
"She's telling the truth," Crispin said, "and so am I."
The two men stared at each other for several seconds, sizing one another up.
"I didn't kill them,"
Crispin finally said, "but I'm pretty sure I know who did." With that, he powered off the weapon, turned it around, and handed it butt-first back to Captain Hunt.
"Your call, Captain."
You have to see what's in here, Chris, Kayla insisted. They weren't kidding when they said this cargo was important.
Chris glared at Crispin as he took his weapon back. Security, full arms, he bellowed to the crewman outside. He looked back at Crispin. This is far from over, mister.
Understood, Captain.
Chris handed his weapon to crewman Sackoff, who had come into the container when his captain called for security. He then climbed inside the container, moved over next to Kayla, and looked at the contents inside.
Holy fuck.
Exactly, Kayla said. Captain Hunt stood there, squatting for a full minute, saying nothing as the weight of his new responsibilities hit him. Finally, Crispin spoke up.
Am I to understand that Nathan Scott is alive?
Chapter 10 Jessica opened the hatch to the captain's ready room, but stopped short when she found the room dark.
Yes? Nathan called from the darkness.
What the hell?
She said, stepping into the darkened room, closing the hatch behind her.
Why are you sitting in the dark?
I was taking a catnap, he said as Jessica turned the lights up to a soft glow.
We're about to attack every Dusan asset in the cluster. How the hell can you sleep?
A catnap isn't sleeping, Jess. It's closing your eyes and sitting still. It's restful. You should try it.
Jessica laughed as she plopped down on the sofa. I don't even like sleeping. It takes too much time.
I tried to take a catnap at least twice a day.
How long do you zone out for?
20 to 30 minutes max, Nathan replied. But it's not zoning out. I'm thinking the whole time.
What were you thinking just now? She asked.
That this plan is insane.
Most of your plans are.
Perhaps.
What are you worried about? Jessica wondered.
You want the entire list?
Not really. What I do want to know is why you're suddenly worrying so much. You didn't used to, or at least you didn't show it much.
I did, and yeah, I tried not to show it. But now for some reason it's worse, Nathan explained. I'm able to see the risks more clearly. I'm able to analyze and predict all the things that could go wrong in a greater number of possible scenarios and in much more detail.
Sounds like a good skill to have, not a bad one, Jessica commented.
It's a double-edged sword, to be honest. Yes, it's good to be able to anticipate so many different variations and outcomes. But when you do so, you realize not only how many ways things can go south, but also how many people you might lose if they do. It can make it very hard to commit to a plan at times.
Have you tried taking a different perspective?
What do you mean? Nathan asked.
The fact that you can more easily predict all the way things can go wrong means you can also develop contingency plans should things go wrong. In other words, when the shit hits the fan, you already know which way it's going to fly, so you can duck.
Yeah, I thought of that, Nathan admitted. Not exactly in those terms, mind you.
So you should be more confident in your plans and decisions.
Nathan sighed, thinking about her words.
Look, Nathan, one of the things that makes you a good captain is your ability to follow your instincts. Maybe you shouldn't think things through so much.
I don't think you understand what instinct is, Jess, Nathan countered. It's not making decisions on a hunch or a gut feeling. It's the ability to process information at a subconscious level. You're still going through the same decision-making process, you just aren't consciously aware of it. That's what repetitive training is all about. When I was going through flight training, we spent hours on end in a simulator doing the same tasks over and over, until we got to a point where we were doing things automatically, without thinking about them. You do the same thing when you train to fight. You repeat moves over and over until you can execute them without even thinking about it. That's what I used to do. I made decisions without thinking about things. Now my mind moves much more quickly than before. At times I feel like I'm waiting for the real world to catch up.
Nathan sighed again.
It can be quite disconcerting.
So what's the solution?
I don't think there is a solution, Nathan admitted. I guess I'll just get used to it.
Jessica leaned forward, her elbows resting on her knees. Nathan, you're looking at it all wrong. You've been given a gift. You're able to analyze things in the blink of an eye that most of us would take hours to process. Is it a burden? Yes. But that's why we risked everything to save you. You've always had this gift. The whole cloning process simply enhanced it. There is so much you can do with these gifts. We simply could not allow you to die. Humanity needs people like you.
And here I thought you saved me because you love me, Nathan quipped.
Jessica leaned back again, rolling her eyes. Love is such a strong word. Like, maybe, but love?
How long until we're recharged and ready to jump? Nathan asked, changing the subject.
We're ready,
Jessica replied. That's what I came in to report, but we still have 20 minutes to zero hour.
Just enough time for another catnap, Nathan joked.
How about you use that super brain of yours to figure out how to get us out of the shit when it does fly? She suggested as she rose to depart. After all, that's a pretty big fan we're about to hit.
Cameron studied the holomap of the Pentaurus cluster at the plotting table in the middle of the makeshift command center aboard the Glendannon. It was the second time she had run a complex operation such as this, from a command post that had been slapped together at the last minute, and the last time her command post had been in the back of a jump shuttle. At least this time she would be inside a much larger ship, larger even than the Aurora. In fact, she felt a little guilty that she was likely to be safer than anyone else on this mission.
"Surely you have every detail of that map memorized by now," Captain Gullen commented as he entered the command center.
"I can't help it," Cameron admitted. "I'm always worried that I miss some tiny detail that will screw everything up."
"And staring at that map for hours on end helps?"
"Honestly, no," Cameron admitted.
She sighed, then turned off the holomap.
"What's up?"
"I just came to see your command center."
Captain Gullen looked around the compartment. There were 4 stations on each side, with room for supervisors to walk behind the controllers. The plotting table at which they both stood was slightly higher, allowing them to see over the shoulders of the controllers, giving them a clear view of all their display screens.
"Seems like a lot of work for a single mission."
"This war has just started, Captain," Cameron reminded him. "I suspect this command center will get used more than once. Besides, during normal operations, it will act as a communications and coordination facility for the fleet, taking some of that workload off your bridge so your people can worry about their own ship."
"So that responsibility won't be on the Aurora?"
"Eventually the Aurora is going to have to spend more time away from the fleet, engaged in hit-and-run operations. There's only so much we can do with gunships and fighters."
"Perhaps we should be concentrating on outfitting some of the cargo ships with weapons, ones that could do some serious damage."
"That is a possibility," Cameron admitted. "However, if we are successful at capturing the Tienta, that may not be necessary."
"But the Tienta is only one ship. Together with the Aurora, that is only 2 ships against 30.
"Sometimes it's not the number of ships, but how you use them," Cameron pointed out.
"I hope you're right," Captain Gullen agreed, "especially considering what we're about to attempt."
"Took you long enough," Loki commented as Josh climbed back up the access ladder into the Seiki's cockpit. "You couldn't have waited until after the mission?"
"Gotta have my pre-flight dump, my friend,"
Josh joked as he climbed into the pilot seat. "Besides, what was I supposed to do, hold it? The mission is only supposed to take 20 minutes. Surely you could have waited."
"Supposed to," Josh pointed out. "Nope, can't do my best flying with my weapons bay full of poo."
Loki just shook his head. "Please, Josh, this is my first command."
"Yeah, pretty cool, huh?"
He glanced at Loki, noticing he looked worried.
"You good?"
"I'm so fucking nervous," Loki admitted. "I can't stop thinking about all the things that could go wrong."
"Relax, Loki, you got this. Besides, we've got the easy part of the mission. Be glad we're not in the Tayenta group. Those guys are screwed."
"You're not helping," Josh laughed.
"Stop worrying. After all, you've got the best pilot in the galaxy on stick. No matter how screwed up things get, I'll get us out alive. You've got my word."
"Still not helping," Loki mumbled. Josh adjusted himself in his seat.
"I'm ready to fly the fuck out of this thing," he declared. "Command me, master."
"Don't call me master," Loki replied.
"Well, I'm sure as hell not calling you sir."
It took considerable concentration for Suvan to go about his workday rituals in a manner that would not raise suspicion, but so far everything had gone just as usual. Until now.
"Ops 442, I'm having a problem here," Suvan reported over comms. "I've got a stuck anchor latch."
"We're not showing any problems on your status board, 442,
the operations controller replied.
"Well, trust me, the thing is stuck. I'm going to reorient to get my hands on it," he said as he bent the crawler over so his arms could reach the bulkhead in front of him.
"Understood. Would you like us to start a rescue crawler?"
"Negative," Suvan replied. "I've only been out here 2 hours, so I've got plenty of time before I'll need extraction."
"Maintenance suggests you do a full reboot if you can't free yourself."
"I'll save that as a last resort. I'd prefer not to free float for 5 minutes, bouncing around off the inside of this flight deck if I can avoid it."
As he spoke, Suvan reached under his console and rerouted several power feeds. After a few minutes of tampering, he called back.
Ops 442, no joy. I'm going to reboot. I've rerouted power to the mag plates in my secondary arm so I won't float away during reboot. If everything is good after the reboot, I'll keep working.
Good thinking, 442. Rescue will be standing by just in case. Pop a rescue strobe if your crawler fails to restart.
Understood, Suvan replied. 442 is rebooting. Talk to you in 5.
Suvan reached under his panel again and pulled the circuit breaker for his crawler's communications and data transceiver, breaking off all voice communications, as well as the data telemetry from his crawler. Then he shut down the power to his crawler.
Suvan inserted his arms into the flexible extruded arms, pushing his fingers under the gloves at the ends. He now had 4 minutes to complete his task.
General Tellus watched from the front of the Aurora's main hangar bay as 100 of his men boarded the collection of Reapers, Ronnie shuttles, and the Aurora's only cargo shuttle. Once again, he would be taking his forces deep into enemy territory. He knew there would be losses both on Coronair and on the Tayenta. Such was the nature of battle. But with each engagement, his forces were reduced, and there were no reinforcements. These men and the 100 or so who were staying behind were the last of the Gata-Jacques. Once they were gone... It saddened him to imagine an end to the Gata-Jacques. Although it was unfortunate that humanity needed such men. Need them they did, and now more than ever. He only hoped that when this war was over there would be enough of them left to train new generations of Gata-Jacques.
"Our forces are nearly loaded, General," Corporal Eliason reported.
"Very well," the General replied.
He glanced at the time display on the starboard bulkhead as the Corporal turned aboard himself. There was still 15 minutes until the battle would begin.
"Eliason," he called before the soldier got out of earshot.
"Yes, sir." "Anyone in your fire team worthy of a promotion?"
"Mitchell, sir, calm under fire, clear thinker, always has your back. I think he's due. Why?"
"Because you're a sergeant now," the general replied. "And you're out of uniform," he added, tossing a small packet of stripes for the corporal to add to his body armor.
Sergeant Eliason caught the pack, looked at it, and smiled.
"Yes, sir," he replied, clenching his fist around the packet of stripes. "Take Parkhead from Technical to replace you on Team 3, and take command of Fire Teams 3 and 4.
"Yes, sir," the sergeant replied.
"Get the Coronari out of there, sergeant," General Tellus stated firmly.
"Do or die, sir," the sergeant replied, snapping a salute to the general.
General Tellus returned the salute, wondering if the newly minted sergeant would be one of those who would not return this day. The general took a breath, looked around one last time, then headed for the Ronnie shuttle that would take him and his team to the Tayenta.
"Those lines aren't rated for that much instant energy transfer, Commander," the engineering tech warned Vladimir.
"That's why we have doubled up all the runs," Vladimir insisted.
"They still won't take a full instant transfer load, sir, you know that."
Vladimir put his arm around the young technician, leading him over to one side of the auxiliary engineering space, which was now stuffed full of additional energy banks taken from several cargo ships just a day ago.
"Of course I know this. That is why we are not going to use them to directly power a jump. We will trickle their power over to the main banks after each jump, at a rate that will not exceed their safety energy transfer levels. I've been doing this for many years, Mr. Hayden. You must trust me."
Of course I trust you, sir,"
Mr. Hayden assured Vladimir, embarrassed that his superior had assumed otherwise.
"Very well," Vladimir replied, patting the young man on the shoulder. "Now go check the secondary banks on the other side of the compartment. Make sure those connections are secure. I expect we are in for quite a shaking."
"Yes, sir,"
the young man replied, departing as instructed. Vladimir waited until the young man disappeared behind the stack of energy cells, then turned and walked quickly in the opposite direction, tapping his comm set.
"Jump control, Chang. Make certain you do not use the additional energy banks to directly power any jumps. Only use them to trickle charge to the main banks. I do not want to transfer lines overheating in the middle of battle. Understood?"
"Yes, sir."
Vladimir breathed a sigh of relief as he glanced at his watch and headed for main engineering. Only 10 minutes before the attack would begin, and there were still 100 things he wanted to double-check yet again. Only you would actually be excited about the prospect of jumping into the middle of an enemy-held system and attacking a heavily guarded shipyard, Kenji commented as he double-checked his instruments.
"Come on,"
Aiden insisted. They're going to be talking about this battle all over the galaxy for decades to come. How can you not be excited about being part of it?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's because there's a very high probability that we'll all get killed, but I'm funny that way.
We're not even jumping in that deep, Aiden argued.
You worry too much.
Not that deep. We're jumping in less than a kilometer from the shipyard, Aiden. How much deeper can you go?
The Gunyoki get to fly through that thing, Aiden reminded. Lucky bastards.
You should be flying with Hayes, Kenji insisted. You're both crazy.
How much time left?
Aiden asked, ignoring his co-pilot's comment.
5 minutes, Kenji groaned.
Aiden tried to contain himself, but failed.
This is going to be awesome, he burst.
Batshit crazy, Kenji said.
Boxcar 4 coasted along its course from a position well outside the Takar system, on an intercept trajectory with the Doosan shipyard orbiting high above Takara. Inside her massive cargo pod waited 6 crawlers, taken from the Glendanon and the Mystic, and repainted with the same yellow coating used on the shipyard's crawlers. There were only 2 differences between these crawlers and the ones used in the shipyards. The first difference was that these crawlers were fitted with single-use jump drives, taken from several of the Aurora's jump missiles. The second difference was that each crawler carried a Gatajok soldier instead of an assembly technician. The massive door to the boxcar's cargo bay opened, lowering slowly until it was level with the bay's deck, forming a platform beyond the gaping bay door. Once fully open, the 6 crawlers executed their ungainly march out the door and onto the platform, in preparation for deployment. Nathan splashed cold water on his face several times, then stood there, hunched over the sink as the water dripped from his nose and chin. After a moment, he reached for a towel and dried himself off. He looked in the mirror. He really did look noticeably younger than he had been as Connor Tuplo. So young and so much responsibility. How can anyone look at this face and take me seriously? The intercom beeped.
Captain Tactical, Jessica called. 3 minutes.
Nathan took a deep breath and sighed, pressing the talk button on the wall-mounted intercom. On my way. Nathan stepped out of the head and walked through his bedroom, picking up his uniform jacket and donning it on his way out. The captain's quarters was only a few steps from the bridge on the port side.
Captain on the bridge, the guard barked.
Time to mission zero? Nathan asked as he entered.
2 minutes now, Captain,
Jessica replied from the tactical station.
Chang, Captain,
Nathan called over his comm set as he continued forward. How are the new auxiliary energy banks looking?
They are ready, Vladimir replied. They will be trickling energy over to the main banks as we go. I believe we can squeeze an extra 8 to 10 light-years total jump energy out of them, but our single jump range will still be limited to 20 light-years.
Just make sure we keep at least 3 to 4 light-years worth of energy in them, Nathan insisted. I don't want to get stuck behind enemy lines without any jump juice left.
Understood.
1 minute,
Jessica warned. Sound general quarters, he ordered, as he sat down in his command chair at the center of the bridge.
General quarters, aye,
Ensign DeBanco replied from the comm station at the back of the bridge. The trim lighting all around the bridge changed from blue to red as the alert klaxon sounded. Nathan turned in his seat to look at Jessica, a worried look on his face.
We never got to hold our pre-battle ritual, you know.
I'd rather hold a victory party,
Jessica replied with a reassuring wink. She glanced down at her tactical display.
All departments report general quarters. Lieutenant Commander Vidmar is in combat, and the chief of the boat is in damage control. All weapons are armed and ready, shields at maximum.
10 seconds to the initial jump point, Ensign Bickle announced from the navigator's chair.
Clear to jump, Nathan ordered.
Clear to jump, aye, the navigator replied. Jumping in 3.
Time to go to work, people, Nathan said, half to himself.
2.
An impish grin formed at the corner of Jessica's mouth as she armed the Aurora's plasma torpedo cannons, setting them for full-power triplet shots.
1.
A million things flashed through Nathan's mind in that last second. The distance they were about to jump, the trajectory at which they would appear in relation to their prospective targets, how many seconds it would take to complete their initial firing pattern before jumping to the next target, and more importantly, the various things that could go wrong and how he would deal with each of them. So many thoughts and calculations, they would surely overwhelm most people. A small, nearly imperceptible smile formed at the corner of Nathan's mouth as a swell of confidence washed over him. He wasn't most people. He was Natan.
Jumping!
The blue-white jump flash translated through the semi-spherical main view screen that wrapped around the forward half of the Aurora's bridge, and subdued by her filters, quickly washed over the bridge, causing Nathan to squint ever so slightly. When the flash faded away a second later, the stars before them had shifted. Most would not have noticed the change, especially when jumping only 2 light years. But to Nathan, the change was obvious, especially along the sides of the view screen, where their movement was more pronounced. The most obvious change, which everyone did notice, was the sudden appearance of a Dusan battleship directly ahead of them, filling half the view screen.
"Jump to Darvino complete,"
the navigator announced, restraining his enthusiasm.
"Super Eagles are launching,"
the systems officer reported.
"Multiple contacts,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported from the sensor station to his left.
"Battleship, 2 frigates, 4 gunships.
"Firing solution on the battleship,"
Jessica reported from the tactical station behind Nathan.
"Weapons free," Nathan instructed.
"First wave of Super Eagles is away."
"Firing plasma torpedoes," Jessica announced. "Combat is locking jump missiles onto the frigates."
Red-orange flashes of light filled the bridge as plasma torpedoes streaked away from under the Aurora's bow.
"Missiles away,"
Jessica added. Nathan glanced at the mission clock. Their first shot had been fired a mere 5 seconds after jumping, and their first wave of missiles had been launched at 8 seconds in.
"Turning to the next jump line,"
Lieutenant Deneve announced as the ship rolled slightly to the right and began a 3-degree turn to starboard. Nathan watched the main view screen as the first round of plasma torpedoes slammed into the unshielded battleship.
"Second wave of jump missiles is away,"
Jessica announced.
"Headed for the battleship."
"Frigates are changing course and raising shields,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona warned. "They're locking their missiles onto us."
"Jumping in 3,
Ensign Bickle began.
"Direct hits with all plasma torpedoes,"
the lieutenant commander added.
2. "Have damage to our number 4 main engine and our aft dorsal shield array."
1.
"Multiple hull breaches as well."
Down but not out, Nathan thought, mentally cataloging the damage to their first target.
"Jumping."
"No damage data on the frigates,"
the sensor officer stated as the jump flash washed over the bridge.
"Jump complete,"
the ship's status officer announced from the front of the makeshift command center on board the Glendanon.
"We are now in the Pentaurus cluster."
"Launch the Gunyoki,"
she ordered.
"Command to all Gunyoki," the comms officer called. "Launch, launch, launch."
"Start the algorithm clock,"
Cameron ordered.
"Clock is running, aye."
"Gunyoki are away."
"Very well."
Cameron glanced at the mission clock, which read 0+15 seconds. "The Aurora has already attacked," she realized. "We're behind the clock," she warned her second officer.
"The old bird takes a little longer to spool up and execute a jump, Captain," he admitted.
"It's my fault, sir. I should have given the order a bit sooner. It won't happen again."
"Thankfully, we're not a combat element in this mission,"
Cameron said, only half meaning it. The truth was, she wished she was in the thick of it along with Nathan, Jessica, and Vladimir. Robert didn't bother to look out his windows when his Cobra gunship jumped into the Darvino system only seconds after the Aurora. He didn't care what was out there, at least not visually. Instead, his eyes were glued to his console. His flight displays, his tactical screen, his target and weapon systems, those were what he fought with, not the view outside. 2 seconds after they arrived, his targeting display began to plot a firing solution on the Dusan cruiser 3 kilometers directly ahead of them. The aiming computers adjusted the angles on the plasma torpedo cannons, and the lock status light turned green. Captain Nash pressed the firing button on his flight control stick, sending 3 waves of plasma torpedoes, 4 red-orange balls of plasma in each wave, streaking toward the distant target. A split second after the 3rd wave of torpedoes left his cannons, he turned 2 degrees to starboard, pressing his jump button as the torpedoes he had just unleashed slammed into the unshielded cruiser. Although his 12 plasma torpedoes would not be enough to bring it down, he took solace in the knowledge that the torpedoes about to be fired by the next gunship, and the ones after that, likely would. And all in the first 20 seconds of the battle.
"Jump complete,"
Loki announced as the Saiki's cockpit windows cleared.
"Holy shit!"
Josh exclaimed, looking out the forward windows.
To his left, a Doosan battleship was experiencing secondary explosions in its number 3 and 4 engines. Its aft shields were flickering on and off as the warship desperately attempted to stabilize the protective layer of energy around its stern.
Talk about a black eye.
Multiple jump flashes, Loki reported as he stared at the Saiki's tactical display.
Reapers, Super Eagles, and Octos.
Loki's voice changed.
6 Doosan Octo fighters, starboard side, 10 clicks, opposite direction just below us. They're headed for the Reapers.
Turning into them, Josh announced as he started a turn to starboard.
Plotting an intercept jump, Loki replied. Gunners, be ready.
No shit, Marcus grumbled over comms.
Reapers, Saiki,
Loki continued over comms.
6 Octos headed your way, 10 clicks to your star. They jumped. They're on your 6. Reapers, evasive.
Jumping. Josh announced as his windows turned opaque. Josh looked out the windows as they cleared, immediately spotting the Doosan Octofighters as they opened fire on the flight of 8 Reapers. 2 of the Reapers took hits on their shields, but all 8 of them successfully jumped away.
Let them have it!
Josh instructed as both Marcus and Dalen opened up on the enemy fighters with the Saiki's topside plasma cannon turrets. Josh tapped his firing button as well, sending wave after wave of plasma torpedoes into the group of Octofighters as they too jumped away.
Fuck!
I got a piece of one of them,
Dalen insisted.
No, you didn't, Marcus corrected.
Where'd the Reapers go?
Josh wondered.
They jumped to the surface,
Loki replied.
So quickly?
Josh wondered.
Damn, those boys are better on the stick than I give them credit.
Turn us in and down toward the deck, Josh. Loki instructed. We have to provide cover for them until they get their shields up.
Can't the Super Eagles do that?
Not yet, Loki explained. They're busy chasing down those Octos, remember?
Tell me you wouldn't rather be in a Super Falcon right now,
Josh challenged his friend.
Not the way you fly it.
Falcon 1's cockpit windows cleared, revealing 2 frigates, one of which was heavily damaged by missile impacts.
2 targets,
Ensign Lassen announced.
Port target is about to come apart. Starboard target has no starboard or aft shields.
I'm taking the starboard target, Lieutenant Tayson replied.
Take the port one with seekers.
Seekers coming up, Sergeant Nama replied from just behind them. Lieutenant Tayson rolled the Falcon slightly to starboard and pitched its nose down, bringing his plasma cannons onto the target and firing a split second later. His plasma bolts walked across the aft end of the Doosan frigate as it attempted to return fire with its meager point defenses. Frigates were designed to fire missiles and then jump out of harm's way, not battle it out with an attacker. But the surprise attack by the Aurora had caught them off guard, and now they were paying the price. Multiple secondary explosions went off all across the aft end of the frigate, separating its drive section from the ship.
Seekers away,
Sergeant Nama announced.
You tore her up, but she ain't out,
Ensign Lassen advised. You want to go back and finish her?
Oh, yeah.
The sergeant exclaimed. 4 seekers, direct impacts, target destroyed.
Negative, the lieutenant told his co-pilot. We've got a schedule to keep. Rico!
He called back to his weapons and systems officer. Drop a comm buoy with a message for the Gunyoki. The second frigate is all theirs.
You got it, LT,
the sergeant replied. Next stop, Savoy, the lieutenant stated as he glanced at the mission clock. The time was 0+23 seconds. 8 jump flashes appeared in the breaking dawn around the perimeter of the old Coronari base outside of Aitkena, the capital of Coronair. Behind those flashes, the Aurora's Reapers, their sweep wings already deployed, dropped nearly straight down from their jump arrival points, only 100 meters above the surface. The Reapers set down in near unison, their landing gear becoming fully deployed only a fraction of a second before touchdown. Dust swirled from the ground beneath them as their downward deflected thruster ducts blasted the surface. As each ship touched down, 3 Gatajonk soldiers jumped out on each side and ran away from their Reapers. They were immediately met with incoming energy weapons fire from nearby guard towers until several Super Eagles jumped in and silenced them. As the Reapers throttled their engines back up and climbed skyward once more, 1 man on either side of each ascending Reaper jammed a tall stake with an emitter node on its tip into the ground in a vertical position. Each stake was equally spaced around the insertion area, resulting in a 300-meter diameter circle of 16 stakes. Volkaguchi still wasn't quite used to suddenly being someplace he wasn't a moment ago. Nevertheless, he did like it, especially the multitude of combat tactics it opened up for him. Unfortunately, it also opened a host of combat tactics against which he would have to defend,
and his opponents would have far more training with those tactics than he.
Shenzhou 1, attacking!
Vol announced as he came out of his jump and found himself closing rapidly on a pair of Dusan Octofighters that were chasing one of the Aurora's Super Eagles. He pressed his firing trigger, unleashing his turrets and sending a barrage of energy bolts spewing toward the enemy targets.
Shenzhou 2, I have your 6, 1.
Just make sure you stick close, Vol replied as he maneuvered to get a clean shot.
The Super Eagle jumped and the pair of Dusan Octofighters turned in opposite directions, also jumping 2 seconds later.
Damn! Vol cursed. Tariq, 115 by 275, plus 10, jumping.
Got it, Vol, right be...
Vol's wingman's transmission was cut short as Vol jumped before it had been completely received. When his canopy cleared, a Dusan gunship was coming straight for him, firing away. Vol's shields lit up, flashing the octagonal patterns formed by its emitter matrix with each impact of the enemy's weapons.
Shields down 20%, Vol, his weapons officer warned. Shenzhou 2, Shenzhou 1, are you there, Tariq?
I'm here. Break left 20 and jump 1 light minute. I'll put a spread of shield busters in this guy's face and follow.
Vol didn't reply, instead just following his wingman's recommendations, rolling his ship into a 20-degree turn to port, and jumping ahead a single light minute. Tariq glanced out the front of his canopy as Vol's gun Yoki fighter rolled out to the left and was enveloped by a subtle glow of blue-white light before vanishing without the usual jump flash. Now, with a clear line of fire, Tariq launched a spread of 12 shield-busting missiles. The stubby little missiles streaked ahead of him, slamming into the incoming gunship.
That did it!
Jova declared from the back seat.
His shields are down!
Hey, somebody take this guy out for me, will ya?
Tariq called as he turned to follow Vol to the post-escape jump rally point.
Shenzhou 3 and 4 are on it!
Tham Kors called over comms from somewhere behind them. Tariq could hear Elena, Imai, and Shenzhou 4 letting out a raccoon battle cry as he jumped away to find Vol in Shenzhou 1.
I'm coming back around now, Josh declared. Keep that up until get this damn up.
Sergeant Eliason ordered over comms from the surface of Coronair. Josh twisted his flight control stick, snap-rolling the Seigi as his gunners fired away at the pursuing Octofighters directly behind them.
Eagles 5 and 6, Seiki. Loki called over comms. We could use some help here. 10 seconds, Seiki.
The gunship Josh was trying to get a firing angle on suddenly jumped away, just as he was about to get a target lock.
Son of a bitch! These guys fly their gunships like you guys fly your Super Eagles!
Energy bolts streamed past the Seiki's cockpit on either side, narrowly missing them. Then the barrage suddenly ended and the ship was rocked by an explosion. Then 2 seconds later, another.
That good, huh? The Super Eagle pilot joked. Your 6 is clear, Josh.
Thanks, Jonesy,
Josh replied. Give me another target, Loki.
Right 12 and down 5, then jump 20 clicks. Another gunship is about to open up on the Gadajok down below.
Not if I can help it,
Josh declared as he turned the ship slightly right, pitched down a touch, and tapped his jump button. A brilliant blue-white flash filled the sky above the battle at the Coronari base, turned prison camp just outside of Aitkena. From behind the flash, one of the ungainly-looking cargo haulers, commonly referred to as a boxcar, came riding down on 4 fiery tails of thrust. The boxcar descended rapidly, slowing at the last minute, and coming to a hover less than a meter above the surface, directly in the middle of the ring of emitter poles the Gadajok had planted less than a minute and a half ago. The boxcar released its cargo pod, allowing it to drop the last half meter to the ground, landing with a ground-shaking thud. The abrupt lightening of its load caused the hauler to suddenly surge upward, giving it just enough forward momentum to jump away, disappearing behind another brilliant flash of blue-white light. Once on the ground, 16 emitters popped up along the edges of the cargo pod. A few seconds later, they began to glow, growing in intensity over several seconds, until a wave of energy spewed outward in all directions. The energy reached the emitter poles the Gadajok had placed around a 300-meter diameter circle 2 minutes ago, and suddenly the entire area, the prison entrance, and the Gadajok themselves, was covered with an invisible shield that flashed yellow and red every time Dusan weapons fire struck its surface. Sergeant Eliason flinched with each incoming heavy plasma fire that rained down from orbit. But to his relief, the shield proved its worth, and the sergeant flinched less and less. He turned to look at his men, yelling, "We're in business, boys!"
Lord Dusan lay naked on the table as two sturdy, yet attractive young Takarn women vigorously rubbed his body with healing herbs and oils native to the area. Such a treatment had become a regular part of his daily routine soon after conquering the Pentaurus Cluster. It was one of the many perks of his position, one which he enjoyed immensely. The doors to the private chamber connected to his office burst open, and General Hessen came charging in, causing the young women to shy away from their duties and cover up their scantily covered bodies.
"What is the meaning of this?" Lord Dusan barked, enraged at the intrusion. "How dare you? A million pardons, my lord, we are under attack."
"What?"
Lord Dusan jumped from the table, grabbing his robe.
"Where?"
"Coronair, my lord," the general explained with urgency. "By the Aurora, 4 gunships and various other ships, including a handful of Gunyoki fighters from Rakuin, equipped with a jump drive that does not reveal their position upon entry."
"What is their objective?"
Lord Dusan demanded to know as he pulled his trousers on. "They have landed nearly 100 soldiers at the prison facility where the Coronari are being held, pending transfer to their work assignments. They have somehow erected a shield over their point of insertion, which also encompasses the entrance to the underground holding facility. This shield protects them from attack, even from bombardment by our gunships in orbit."
"What about the Jar Jeffin? How many frigates are in the system?"
Lord Dusan inquired as he continued dressing. He glanced at the two girls cowering to the side.
"Be gone,"
he barked, sending them scurrying toward the exit.
"The Jeffin is damaged and is having trouble maneuvering. However, she can still defend herself. She is moving away from the planet to avoid being pulled in by its gravity should its propulsion systems degrade further."
"And the frigates? What about the frigates?"
Lord Dusan demanded as he pulled on his boots.
"They have both been destroyed, my lord," General Hessen replied. "I believe they intend to attempt a rescue of the Coronari."
Lord Dusan smiled as he donned his uniform jacket.
"I knew it. I knew that idiot child would try to rescue his friends. They must be desperate for manpower, which means that Rakuin has not yet pledged their support."
"But the Gunyoki are attacking as well,"
General Hessen reminded his lord.
"The Gunyoki do what they want without need for approval by their own government. You read the intelligence reports. Their presence means nothing, and the fact that Scott is trying to rescue trained warriors is quite telling."
Lord Dusan shook his finger in the air, thinking.
"As is that shield. They expect difficulty extracting such numbers."
Lord Dusan headed for the door to his office, and General Hessen fell in behind him.
"Send the Jar Inta and the Jar Belleron to Coronair,"
he ordered as he passed through his private chamber to his main office.
"Send all Xehanort on Coronair to the prison. We will squash them, all 100 of them, denying them the additional manpower and weakening them further still in the process."
Lord Dusan turned to the general.
"Not a single Gutajok gets off the surface alive, understood?"
"Yes, my lord,"
General Hessen replied.
"And what of the Aurora?"
"What of her?
Destroy her, of course."
"She has proven a formidable opponent in the past, my lord,"
General Hessen warned.
"That is why I am sending 2 battleships,"
Lord Dusan reminded him, annoyed at the general's inference.
"Might I suggest that we order our older ships that are still in port to begin spooling up their reactors in case we need them?"
"Nonsense,"
Lord Dusan laughed.
"With all due respect, my lord, we cannot afford to lose 3 battleships."
"I think you are giving the boy who would be captain too much credit, my old friend."
Lord Dusan thought for a moment.
"However, if you must, you may also pull additional ships out of nearby systems, such as Rama or Hayden, for example."
"A wise decision, my lord,"
the general said with a respectful nod.
"I suggest you tell Captain Montun and Captain Jeriza that they had better destroy the Aurora if they wish to keep their commands."
"Jump to Savoy complete," the Aurora's navigator announced. "Multiple contacts,"
Lieutenant Commander Kono reported from the sensor station. 4 gunships, a cruiser, and multiple cargo ships, all in orbit over Ancot."
"Helm bear on the cruiser and prepare to jump in close under her," Nathan ordered. "Tactical missiles for the gunships, and ready plasma cannons for any survivors when we jump in."
"Bearing on the cruiser, aye,"
Lieutenant Denev acknowledged.
"Locking missiles on the gunships," Jessica followed.
"Mr. Bickle will jump in below and half a click aft of the target," Nathan continued. "Lieutenant, pitch up 45 degrees as we jump."
"Missiles away,"
Jessica reported.
"Plotting jump,"
the navigator replied.
45 up as we jump, aye."
"Cruiser is raising shields,"
Lieutenant Commander Kono warned. "She knows we're here, sir." 4 jump flashes appeared on the main view screen as the missiles Jessica had just launched jumped toward their targets.
Gunships are jumping, the lieutenant commander announced.
Damn it,
Jessica cursed. No problem, Nathan reminded her. Safety those birds and jump them to the recovery zone so we can pick them up later.
Already on it,
Jessica assured him. On course and pitching up, Lieutenant Deneve reported.
Cruiser is launching missiles, Lieutenant Commander Kono warned. They're jump missiles.
Full power hard to port and upward, Nathan ordered. Lieutenant Deneve didn't wait to acknowledge or respond, immediately bringing the Aurora's main engines to full power and altering her course to port and upward. A split second later, four jump missiles appeared from behind flashes of blue-white light, just to their right side, streaking past them harmlessly.
Return the favor, Jess, Nathan ordered.
I'm on it, she replied.
Escape jump after the missiles are away, Nathan continued.
Escape jump I, Mr. Bickle replied.
Jump line is clear.
Missiles away.
Escape jump,
Nathan ordered, the blue-white jump flash appearing as the words crossed his lips. Robert flinched as four missiles struck the Doosan cruiser's shields, moments after he jumped in near the enemy warship. Without thinking, he pressed and held his firing button.
"Gunners, pound their aft shields!"
he ordered as he sent plasma torpedoes streaking toward the cruiser. A moment later, bolts of energy from his port and starboard gun turrets were added to the barrage.
"You can't continue firing torpedoes like that, sir," Lieutenant Kraska warned. "You'll overheat the plasma generators."
Robert ignored his co-pilot's warnings and continued firing.
"Striker 2, Striker 1, you there, Gil?"
1-2, just arrived," Gil replied. "Any girls left to dance with?"
"A hot one, right in front of me. Keep up the onslaught on our aft shields for me, will ya?"
Robert suggested. "My tubes are about to melt."
"You got it," Gil replied. "Peel right and bug out. Now."
Robert immediately rolled his gunship into a tight right turn, tapping his jump button as soon as he got a clear jump line. Gil Rozelle squinted from the blue-white flash as the gunship before him jumped away. Without waiting for his targeting computers to calculate a firing solution, he too pressed his firing trigger and held it down, sending a constant stream of plasma torpedoes slamming into the Doosan cruiser's weakening aft shields.
"Gunners, join the party," Gil suggested. "Roby, just as soon as those kids jump in behind us, tell them to cut in on my dance partner here."
"Understood, sir,"
his sensor officer replied.
"Damn, this sure beats the hell out of sitting in a command chair and barking out orders while everyone else has all the fun."
"Reaper 2, circle north. Target the north and east towers," Loki instructed from the Seiki's cockpit as Josh brought the ship around to jump toward the gunships still pounding the Gadajank shield on the surface of Coronair.
"Reaper 5, target the south and west towers."
"Reaper 2, circling north,"
the Reaper's co-pilot responded. "Target north and east towers."
"Reaper 5, taking south and west."
"You got your jump line?"
Loki asked Josh.
"Don't worry about what this ship is doing," Josh insisted. "You just keep everyone else on their game. I'll handle harassing those damned gunships."
"Thanks," Loki replied. "But don't forget to keep us alive while you're at it, okay?"
"All part of the plan,"
Josh said as he put the Seiki into a tight roll and pressed the jump button. As soon as they came out of the jump, Josh spotted his next target and turned towards it, firing away.
Jump to Rama is complete. By now the Aurora's navigator was getting a little more comfortable with the fast-paced battle and the constantly changing locations in which they were fighting. In addition, Nathan had noticed that his entire bridge crew was developing a routine, taking turns acknowledging orders whenever possible and giving their captain exactly the information he needed when it was needed.
"No cruisers," Lieutenant Commander Kono reported. 6 gunships, 3 in low orbit around Paradino, the other 3 at the planet's L3 point, range to nearest 3 light minutes."
"I got 'em,"
Jessica replied.
"Locking 2 missiles on..."
"Wait, you got something coming around Paradino's third moon, Layla?"
"Yep, it's a cruiser, and she's a heavy. Range is 2.5 light minutes."
"Helm turn toward the cruiser," Nathan instructed. "Roll us over and jump us in above her."
"Recommend a 2-part jump, torpedoes, then big guns," Jessica suggested.
"Correction, Lieutenant," Nathan followed. "Jump us in 2 clicks in front of the target as she comes around that moon to bear on us. 2 clicks down as well. We'll jump in pitched up to fire on her. Then pitch back level as you jump forward, sliding in directly under her bow. And give us just enough pitch to one side so we can get our topside guns and our broadside guns on that cruiser as well."
"Aye, sir,"
Lieutenant Deneve replied.
"Missiles are away,"
Jessica reported. 12 small flashes of blue-white light appeared before them as their missiles jumped away toward their distant targets. In orbit above Rama's third planet, six blue-white flashes of light momentarily hid the arrival of six instruments of destruction, appearing less than a kilometer from their targets, and closing at blinding speeds. 2 seconds later, before any of the three gunships could raise their shields, spin up their point defenses, or jump to safety, the missiles slammed into them, penetrating their unprotected hulls and detonating deep within them. The result was complete destruction of all three gunships. At the same time, more than 500,000 kilometers away, three more gunships met identical fates.
"Jump complete," Mr. Bickle reported as the Aurora's jump flash faded. "Firing all tubes," Jessica announced. "Rolling to port," Lieutenant Deneve added.
Nathan watched as the image of the Doosan heavy cruiser rotated 45 degrees on the main view screen, while a stream of plasma torpedoes leapt from the Aurora's tubes and slammed into the cruiser's shields, causing them to flash red-orange with each impact.
"Target somehow managed to get her shields up," Lieutenant Commander Kona reported in disbelief.
"We might have been 2 light minutes out," Nathan said.
"But that cruiser was only 20 light seconds from the gunships at L3,
Jessica finished for him.
"But you expected that, didn't you?"
Nathan didn't respond. He was too busy calculating all the different ways the cruiser's captain could defend against their attack and possibly even retaliate.
"Losing my angle on the tubes," Jessica reported, "switching to topside cannons."
"Cruiser is painting us," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned.
"Guns and missiles.
Laying down point defense fire between us and the target," Jessica assured him.
"Broadside cannons in 10 seconds.
Target is firing rail guns and plasma cannons," Lieutenant Commander Kono reported. A moment later, the Aurora shields began to light up as plasma charges and heavy railgun rounds slammed into them. The ship rocked with each impact, but their shields held, even against an onslaught from such close range.
"Broadsides are firing," Jessica reported. "Target is launching missiles."
The Aurora pitched down slowly as she passed under the Doosan heavy cruiser. Her topside plasma and heavy railgun cannons exchanged like-kind fire with the enemy vessel, each of them pounding away at the other's defensive shields, hoping to bring the others down before their own collapsed. Missiles leapt from the cruiser's side launch tubes, but were intercepted by the defense layer of fragmenting railgun rounds being created by the Aurora's point defense cannons. The result of the exchange was a fiery display of destructive force, as each tried to destroy the other as they passed one another in the cold vacuum of space.
"Target shields are down to 30%, Lieutenant Commander Kono reported.
"Our shields are down to 40%, the systems officer warned.
"I'm losing angle on the broadside cannons," Jessica warned.
"Give me some yaw, Lieutenant."
"I'm on it,"
Lieutenant Deneve replied from the helm.
20%,
Lieutenant Commander Kono reported.
"Keep on them, people."
30%, the Aurora's systems officer warned.
"Target is channeling emergency power into her shields," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned.
"They're trying to outlast us."
"Throw everything we've got at them, Jess,"
Nathan urged as the ship shook violently.
"I am."
10% and almost holding," Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
"Our shields are down to 15%, Captain."
"All available power to shields," Nathan barked.
9% and holding,"
Layla reported, concern creeping into her tone.
"Escape jump ready, Captain,"
Mr. Bickle announced, hoping that his captain would take the hint.
"Not yet, Mr. Bickle, not yet,"
Nathan insisted.
10%,
the Aurora systems officer warned, barely containing his panic.
"And falling!"
"Not yet," Nathan instructed calmly, glancing at the mission clock.
"Jump flashes,"
the lieutenant commander announced.
5%,
the systems officer yelled.
"Cobra gunships directly astern. 2 clicks, they're firing."
A dozen red-orange balls of plasma streaked past the Aurora semi-spherical main view screen, slamming into the Doosan heavy cruiser's nearly depleted shields, draining the last of its energy from them, and causing emitters all over the underside of the warship's hull to overheat and explode in jets of showering sparks. The shield flashes ceased, and all the plasma energy and railgun rounds from all three Alliance ships slammed into the Doosan cruiser's hull, tearing it open. Nathan watched without emotion or expression as a warship more than twice the Aurora's size split open and then broke into several more pieces, ripped to shreds by a never-ending series of secondary explosions.
"Anything left to kill here?"
Nathan asked his sensor officer calmly.
"Negative, sir,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona replied with satisfaction.
"Very nice," Jessica mumbled.
"Comms, pop a comm drone and update command," Nathan instructed.
"Aye, sir."
Lieutenant Deneve set a course for the Takar system.
Takar system, aye.
Lieutenant Deneve replied from the Aurora's helm. Nathan fought back the urge to smile. So far, things were going better than expected. But there was still plenty of time for their fortunes to change. Like Jessica had said, they were about to jump into an awfully big fan.
Status report,
Lord Dusan barked as he and General Hessen walked into the command center on Takara.
My lord,
the officer of the watch began, we are receiving word of attacks on Savoy and Rama as well.
How bad?
General Hessen asked. We have lost several gunships in the Savoy system, and Rama is now undefended.
My lord,
General Hessen said, turning to Lord Dusan, we must send one of our battleships to the Savoy system to protect Ancot.
There's nothing but farmers on Ancot,
Lord Dusan replied. Farmers who supply 70% of the food the people of this system consume, General Hessen reminded his leader, including our own.
Now I am to send battleships to defend grain silos,
Lord Dusan said in disgust.
General Hessen, you scramble every ship we have. Do you understand me? I want the boy captain and his precious little ship out of my hair, permanently, even if I have to do it myself. Do I make myself clear?
Unmistakably, my lord, General Hessen replied, his voice curt. Shall I summon your shuttle, my lord? Lord Dusan looked quizzically at his general.
In case you choose to lead the attack against the Aurora yourself, my lord.
Lord Dusan stared at the general, displeased with his tone.
Do not think that because our fathers were friends, that I will tolerate your disrespect, general.
No disrespect intended, my lord, General Hessen assured him. I merely wish to provide you with all the options for which you might desire. Lord Dusan said nothing but simply glared at the elder general.
Now if you'll excuse me, my lord, I'd like to carry out your orders.
Lord Dusan watched as General Hessen began barking out orders to the men in the command center. As he watched, he looked to his personal aide, who stepped closer, sensing his lord's need to speak with him.
See to my shuttle. Contact my flagship and tell them to be ready to get underway,
he instructed in hushed tone so the general would not hear him.
As you wish, my lord.
Lord Dusan touched his aide's sleeve, causing the man to pause before departing.
And bring me my sidearm.
Charlie Leader, Boxcar 4, 30 seconds to release.
Understood.
Lieutenant Rezik scanned the console on his crawler, checking that all systems were operating normally. Then he checked the data pad that had been added to control the single-use fixed-distance jump drive which had been installed on all six of Charlie Team's crawlers.
Charlie Team Leader, jump sequencers to auto, prepare for release.
Once again, the mighty God of Jacques are about to go down in history for another daring act of bravery. Corporal Chodan announced over comms.
Stow it, Chodan,
the lieutenant ordered as he activated the jump drive auto-sequencer on his data pad.
10 seconds.
The lieutenant monitored his console as the controller from Boxcar 4 counted down the last few seconds. At zero, the mag locks on the pads of the crawler arms deactivated, and the artificial gravity, generated by the platform on which they stood, dropped to nothing, allowing them to float freely.
Thrusting downward and away,
the boxcar's pilot announced over comms. Despite the fact that they were moving through space at 1 meter per second greater than the orbital velocity of the shipyard orbiting above Takara, all six crawlers appeared motionless as the boxcar descended down and away from them. The boxcar continued to fire its thrusters in tiny bursts, causing the distance between the crawlers and the boxcar to grow at an ever-increasing rate. A minute after releasing the crawlers, the boxcar was far enough away to safely depart.
Safe jump range,
the pilot of the boxcar called. Good luck, gentlemen. Lieutenant Rezik's crawler filled momentarily with the blue-white light from the boxcar's jump flash as it departed, leaving him and his men coasting toward their target just under 2 light-years away.
Gentlemen?
Corporal Chodan wondered.
Why'd he call us gentlemen? We're dangerous killers, we are.
Dangerous killers who talk too much, the lieutenant mumbled.
Heads up, gentlemen. Jumping in 3, 2, 1, jumping.
6 yellow and black crawlers disappeared in unison without jump flashes, leaving no evidence that they had ever been floating freely in that part of space.
Jump complete,
Mr. Bickle announced as the jump flash faded from the Aurora's bridge.
Open fire,
Nathan ordered as the bridge flashed red-orange. On the semispherical view screen, a black and crimson Dusan cruiser moved from left to right across their screen, obviously underway on a departure course from the Takarn orbital shipyards, which lay directly to their port side. Groups of four plasma torpedoes streaked forth from under their nose, along with a steady stream of plasma cannon fire from all six of their forward dorsal and ventral gun turrets. The energy charges slammed into the cruiser shields, which were already raised as expected.